The eerie futuristic theme to the BBC sci-fi series Doctor Who, a tune that scared the living daylights out of a generation of children and which is also now recognised as one of the most influential pieces of music ever recorded. The composition is credited to Ron Granger, but the work was realised, is the way they put it, as an electronic piece by Delia Derbyshire at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And to this day, Derbyshire is credited as one of the great pioneers of synthesised music, an icon of the electronic superstars that were to come in later decades. And Tony Clayton Lee is with us this evening to look at the foundations of electronic music from Delia Derbyshire through to Kraftwerk and Brian Eno. 1963 is where that piece came from. And Delia Derbyshire, they didn't have composers, or you couldn't employ composers in the BBC as staff. Delia Derbyshire was a staff member, and hence she just realised that piece of music. How radical was what she and others were doing at that time, Tony?
You can tell by the intro that you've just given, Sean, that it was quite radical in the sense that, number one, no one had ever really done it before to the extent that Derbyshire did. I mean, she had a very interesting background briefly. She, very clever, very, very brainy, accepted at both Oxford and Cambridge. She applied after graduating to Decca Records for a position there, only to be told by Decca Records that the company didn't employ women in their recording studios. So she went to Europe, came back to the UK, started working in the BBC in 1960 at the, as you said, the Radiophonic Workshop. And it was there that she really applied her intuitive knowledge of the then really quite basic electronic instrumentation. I mean, there, you know, I think we're right that the kind of cutoff point that we're starting at is around the 1960s. Previous to that, there had been other kind of, you know, pioneering composers, really, more so than musicians, such as John Cage, Stockhausen, Edgar Varese. But Delia kind of came pretty much in line with the nascent experimentation of other musicians as well. One of the interesting things about the Radiophonic Workshop, and as you mentioned in the intro, the kind of credit of electronically realising the theme tune written by Ron Granger, as you said, was that she didn't receive a co-writing credit until the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. And that is because throughout the 60s and 70s and possibly even the 80s, the BBC wanted their own Radiophonic Workshop personnel to be completely anonymous. In other words, they wanted the workshop people to work as a kind of united team, with there being nobody singled out.
And Ron Granger, to be fair, felt that she should be credited as co-composer. He wasn't looking for all the glory.
Yeah. Absolutely, because he realised when she had presented her own realisation of his theme tune, he expressed surprise and asked, who is that boy? Who wrote that piece of music? And she had to explain to him that the treatment was so radical, but also so much of her own mind as well, that it actually was his piece of music.
Yeah, and I mean, it is amazing to watch how she does. I saw a documentary where it goes through how she was looping tape, 4-inch tape around studios to create these various sounds. It's incredible stuff.
Very, very, very time-consuming, obviously.
Yeah. What about Robert Moog and the synthesizer? Where does that fit into this part of the story?
Well, Robert Moog invented the synthesizer with the help of another electronic music pioneer, Wendy Carlos, whom I think we'll be talking about. And he, Moog, the Moog organization, effectively, I suppose they literally downsized the equipment to make it portable. When I say portable, I still think you'd need a kind of sack barrel to kind of lift it from, you know, stage to kind of ground, but portable in the sense that you could actually transport it relatively easily from one venue to the next and from one studio to the next. So what the Moog synthesizer did was it compacted electronically, digitally, you know, very, very archaic instrumentation that would have involved diodes, triodes, lots of valve technology as it was known, and just made music more portable. It still took time to kind of create a piece of music from the Moog synthesizer, but it certainly truncated an awful lot of what went into making the music.
Wendy Carlos, then, we've mentioned briefly already. It was her involvement with the music of Bach that is particularly notable, I think.
Yeah, in 1968, she released an album called Switched On Bach, which were 10 pieces by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Carlos on the very Moog synthesizer that she helped to enhance and create. Yeah, exactly. I mean, clearly, the release of such a kind of record, it raised hackles amongst the classical music conservatives, traditionalists, but was intuitively directed towards younger people, towards younger people of the day. So, which I think in itself, you know, getting kind of, you know, teenagers, early 20s people connected into that kind of music was a kind of small cultural revolution on its own. And one of the really interesting things about the Switched On Bach album was that the Canadian pianist, Glenn Gould, a lot of people would know him as being an internationally renowned interpreter of Bach's keyboard works. He described the album as being one of the great feats in the history of keyboard performances, which I think certainly gave it a sense of credibility within the classical music area.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to part of Switched On Bach from 1968, the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, first movement. There you go, Bach, as you may have heard him before or may not have heard him before, from the 1968 album Switched On Bach, Wendy Carlos and the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, a little section from the first movement. I would have liked it a little bit faster, but that's just my taste in the way Bach should be performed. Sadly, we were speaking about Kraftwerk the other night because of the death of Florian Schneider. You know, we're not going to go too far down that road, but they were hugely influential, obviously, Tony.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as you say, the Kraftwerk were, you know, covered quite sadly last week. And yeah, but I think it has to be said that they were absolutely, they still are, you know, unquestionably one of the most influential groups ever, widely considered to be the most important electronic music innovators and pioneers. And maybe that's all we should say, because
yes, of course,
that's quite a fact well known. I think it's fair to kind of give the other people that we're going to be talking about their little bit of time too.
Well, I think this particular man maybe did, if not huge innovation, it was about popularizing in some ways the whole electronic music movement. Jean-Michel Jarre. It really, I don't know what kind of memories that brings back to you, Tony, but it brings back very specific memories to me of trying to play that particular tune, which for some reason was a fashion at the time, playing it on your cheeks, you know, through your hollow mouth.
Yes.
Do you remember doing that?
I don't actually. And I'll tell you the reason why, Sean. I mean, if this were a very subjective view of my favourite pieces of electronic music, I'm afraid much as you know, as popular as the album was, and it sold millions and millions, and it really did kind of, you know, deliver a kind of electronic music to the population at large. I always viewed Jean-Michel Jarre and this album in particular as kind of quite derivative and kind of weak, particularly particularly when you compared it to other, you know, music, German particularly, other music acts such as Tangerine Dream and Klaus Schulze and the Evergreen Kraftwerk. Yet even, it's interesting, even in the era, this was released in 1976, 77, I think it became really, really popular. Even in the era of punk rock, the album nonetheless touched a nerve. But I've always been of the opinion that, you know, the people who didn't really like punk, who thought it was maybe too rough and ready and shoddy for them, they kind of gravitated right towards Jean-Michel Jarre.
Well, I suppose we shouldn't throw away all French electronic music, because you'd have to think about Daft Punk and Air as well, wouldn't you, in that mix?
Absolutely. I mean, it is on record that the likes of Daft Punk and Air, they were very, very firmly influenced by Jean-Michel Jarre, not just the Oxygen album, but, you know, quite a few of his. So I'm not being totally derogative, but I'm just saying that from a subjective point of view, he would not have been my favourite.
And in the 1970s then, and if we're speaking of the United Kingdom in particular, we'd have to think of the likes of Brian Eno, Human League.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Eno absolutely, I think, gravitated towards a far more ambient kind of but kind of almost neoclassical way. His first, I think his first long form piece of electronic music was with another musician, a guy called Robert Fripp. Their album was called No Pussyfooting, which was two sides of extended pulsing and throbbing in a very kind of nice and gentle way. But I think really the one song that I think really brought electronic music to the fore, particularly in the UK, was Being Boiled by the Human League. You know, again, this was released in 1978. It was a purely electronic created record, created with electronic instruments. Again, you would have thought that, you know, the punk rock people, which would have been one of myself, I have to add, would have clubbed a song like this to death. But I think what really kind of caught my imagination, and I think many, many other people's, was that there was such a sparse atmosphere to the song. And also it was very odd. You know, the band looked quite odd with Phil Oakey and his kind of one-sided haircut. So I thought that the song and the subsequent albums that it came from kind of perfectly synced in with punk's DIY approaches, and also, you know, punk's post-punk's increasing musical divergences.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to slip Donna Summer and I Feel Love in underneath this as you're giving me the answer to this final question.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking Marauder and Donna Summer. How important is where we went to in this kind of real popular realisation of electronica?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's again, you got to join the dots here. One of Giorgio Moroder's most referencing, most influential albums for him was Switched On Bach by Wendy Carlos. So, you know, he obviously went on, he processed, he graduated from one field to the next. But with this particular song, I Feel Love, with vocals by Donna Summer and with a kind of kick drum by Keith Forsey. Beside from those two, the song is completely electronically based. It's regarded as the first electronic disco masterpiece and the track that was crucial to the development of synth pop and techno music. For my mind, the song just didn't suggest the future. You know, for a time back in the mid to late 70s, it actually was the future.
There she goes, Donna Summer and I Feel Love, and Tony Clayton Lee will be discussing the foundations of other popular music genres and forms in the coming weeks and months here on Arena. But that's it for this evening, just in time for me to clear my throat. It's Paula Shields and Leah Murphy were the researchers this evening. Jimmy Doyle was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator in tonight's programme, produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.